Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and our in-studio guest today is Ted Becker. Ted is the owner and broker of RE/MAX Results in Moreno Valley, a company started in 1989. Ted has an awful lot of experience in real estate. He's been able to train and lead 35 of Southern California's highest producing real estate brokers and agents to close deals quickly and efficiently for a variety of clients in commercial, residential, multifamily, and office real estate. Nationwide Home Loans, Inc., RE/MAX Results Escrow Divisions are associated companies. Before opening RE/MAX Results, he's been a lawyer, a home builder, a contractor. So, Ted, we welcome you to our show.
Thank you, Bruce.
Once again.
Happy to be here.
Is that 35 still a...
It's probably more like 25 today.
Okay.
But we're, I think, 25 of the most productive people you've probably run into.
I think you're right. I've been there, and certainly you have a very diverse background. I'm just curious, when I saw the builder part, what years were you builder?
Well, unfortunately, I built from about 1979 right into the 1982 recession. For me, it was a severe depression, actually.
Yeah.
But so I had a real baptism by fire, but it did teach me not to get into the building trades.
Wait, you know, in 79, you would have been at a happy market.
And that's, would have been.
Yeah.
That should have been.
Well, it kind of was until very shortly thereafter, interest rates got to be in construction loans, like 20% or something.
Correct.
Okay.
And, right about when all the beautiful homes that I built were finished, there was no market. So,
okay,
we had to say goodbye.
Do we have auctions or just?
We learned how to give properties back to the bank.
Okay. Well, there's no alternative, especially clipping along at 20% interest. but you know what's interesting about that is that that's exactly the era that I got involved in real estate. Exactly. I got involved in 80 buying houses for a company and interest rates just went nuts. And I didn't know any different. And that kind of colors how you look at the market. Creativity was very necessary in 80 to 82. If you were going to sell anything, it was going to be some hybrid of something.
Well, that's true. And the creativity continues even today. But that probably was the birth of my creative juices in real estate.
Yeah, it was necessary. And what's interesting too is that you and I have a very different take on what interest rates could be. You know, we don't think 4% is high.
Correct.
Somebody borrowing right now is going, oh no, it's 4.
Yeah, it could go up to 5. Oh no.
Yeah, we have to laugh. I remember very clearly somebody that I respected saying, you will never see below 10% ever again. And it made sense. I was at 15 or something. I refied my house to become an investor at 17.5 fixed. And when I got to refi that about 2 or 3 years later at 12.5, I just thought, wow, what a home run.
You thought you're a genius,
yeah.
Like most of us did.
It was great. So you sold real estate during the 82 to 89. So that wasn't much fun either.
No, but I was in commercial real estate during that time, and
okay.
that market was
very
booming
different.
Until the 1986 Tax Reform Act,
right.
which changed general and limited partnerships forever,
right.
and virtually pulled the bottom out of the market. And so I would like to say that in that first decade, I experienced more than most people do in a lifetime.
Yeah, you took the commercial hit of all hits.
Right.
Because it had gotten crazy because of the impetus of you get to write off everything against your earnings as a doctor, right?
Right.
Something like
Every
that.
Doctor was buying real estate, apartment buildings faster than you could find them.
For prices that wouldn't matter
and
to them.
And writing off everything they put up
right.
in the first year or two. And it was phenomenal. But it sure was a nice market to work in for
yeah.
a while.
that I didn't realize. That's an interesting story. Well, that also gives you concern when you see policies. You know, that's the wild card that's been playing out over the last 10, almost 8 years now, I guess, is policy changes, where you look at a chart that usually means this, and you realize, wait a minute, we didn't really foreclose on everybody, or we, you
right.
know, we have jobs, but we don't have full-time jobs. And
the factors that drove the market 10 years ago are not driving it today.
No, it's constantly something that, you know, because I pay attention to that all the time. And you're always looking at what you were so sure of with a fine tooth comb going.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, maybe it's different now. Now you started a company in 89. You pick interesting years to do things. Okay. 89, you're at the top of a boom again.
Correct.
And a couple of years later, it starts a 6-year slide, sort of. Not a crash like we had, but it didn't feel good.
You know, you said before, not knowing what you were getting into, it's kind of, I made the switch from commercial to residential real estate in those days. And for me, it was much the same. Having seen the commercial side fall, I never dreamed that kind of thing would happen to such a degree in the residential side, but I didn't really know that well. Mm-hmm. So I guess you could say I took a chance. I think I took sort of a blind chance, but it's worked out, but there were some tough years.
Well, from 89, where you peak in price and you go into the 90s, all of a sudden there was an REO market that never had existed before.
Correct.
And you found a way to take advantage of that.
Well, back then there were a lot of different fears that aren't extant today. But yes, we got into doing what we would call today subject to transactions, land contracts, AITDs. I happen to prefer land contracts. As an attorney, I was looking for the least exposure to the lender finding out that there was something going on with the lender's loan. And in those days, as you'll recall, lenders were actually going after and foreclosing on people or at least the perception was that lenders would go after a person for selling a home and not paying off the loan. Whether they really did or not, I can't say, but that was the fear.
Well, you had a fair amount of transactions to give that try.
I'll say we survived in the 90s, basically the last half of the 90s, by doing, my preference was land contracts because the deed didn't record at the time of the transaction. It recorded later. Again, out of fear that the lender would discover the transaction. But yes, we probably did 1,000 of them in the late part of the 90s, probably more. And I will say that maybe 2 or 3 of them actually went bad on us or turned into arguments. All the rest worked.
Which is ridiculous. That's better than any foreclosure rate or delinquency rate of Fannie Mae in their best year.
I was pretty cautious. I mean, I was a lawyer, and so I'm concerned about doing something that's wrong or perceived to be wrong that I can be turned back on me, I guess, and say, you should have known better. You shouldn't have done that.
Right.
For me to advise someone to break a rule or break a law is not appropriate. For a layman to do that seems to be okay. So that was my fear through the whole thing. And I think because we were so judicious about disclosing to both the buyer and the seller in these transactions, and they both really did understand what they were doing, the transactions didn't go bad.
Well, part of that, if you pick the era of, let's say, after 95, then it was pretty quickly after that you had some price increases, which helps that transaction
stick together. That cleans up the mess, correct.
Right. They have equity, they refi it, and everybody goes home happy.
Right.
The original discussion has almost everybody looking at it going, I don't know. So you have a seller who's going to sell and their name still's on the loan, and you have a guy buying a property and it's not getting transferred to him, but his name's not on the loan. So he's wondering, how could I own this thing? And the brokers that except for you are going, there's no way we're going to do that transaction.
Most were very much afraid. And I suppose I would probably have been afraid in the beginning, but there was no other option.
Yeah.
In most cases. Buyers wanted to buy, but they either couldn't get a loan or they didn't have enough money. They had the income, but they didn't have the savings, all those factors. And sellers in those days, many of them just had to get out. And they were willing to take those risks.
Now, the difference in the bad run that we've had now, we've had way more upside-down properties, but we haven't had a motivated seller. Is that part of it?
The seller who's been living in his house for 4 years for free is not very motivated to do anything.
No.
So, yes, that is the problem.
That has been the problem.
And that's government interference at its absolute best.
Yeah, they have they've done a good job of, now I think, this is not sort of a political statement, but I think college students have watched that and go, you know, I've got this college debt I don't feel like paying. And I know that there's people that are calling on the phone, these kids that have this debt, that they're trying to negotiate things sort of like that hybrid of this, of the mortgage.
Right. And we hear Washington talking about softening the blow of the debt, partially forgiving and so forth. So, I mean, that's essentially what happened in many cases with people who owned houses.
Yeah. During the 90s, were you involved in REO listings? When did that start to become part of the business? Because not everybody gets into that.
No, we really weren't. I think we were too new a company, or maybe we just didn't have enough people with enough experience to have been involved.
There just never had been that quantity, though, ever.
Correct.
So no one would have had a blueprint. Okay, well, now we'll go list REOs.
Right. But we, and maybe part of it was that we solved the problem as easily as we did with land contracts, AITDs, that sort of solution. At least in our office, in my office, we, maybe without even realizing it, we solved the problems that would have otherwise caused more REOs.
Oh, there's no doubt.
Yeah.
I mean, that would have been a smart thing to do in this last cycle if you could have had somebody take over a 4% mortgage. You know, that's the big difference in the 90s. You didn't have a mortgage rate that started with a 4.
Right.
You had mortgage rates that would start with 7 to 10 or
right.
something like that. And you were still able to put A and B together and be successful 99 point something percent.
7's better than 12.
Well, you know, that's, you wonder why something so practical wouldn't have been implemented. You know, that's years ago when we really started having the downturn, 09, you know, I was talking about that, just a simple assumption, and especially in places like Texas where you didn't have price hits. You could just have somebody walk in and take over a payment. And that just,
Well, and with all of the government interference, I will say, that's probably the wrong word politically to use, but with all the government changes in the marketplace, you're right. Why wouldn't we just do that? The lender really doesn't care. As long as the lender's money's coming in every month, why would they care if Joe takes over for Fred and makes the payments? Theoretically, they shouldn't. Right. I realize there's a risk factor on the lender's side, but that's pretty theoretical when you get to the actual day-to-day collecting money, buyers paying, and everybody's happy.
Well, usually when you're getting involved in that transaction, there's already risk for the lender. Somebody's getting ready not to pay, or they're not paying.
Correct.
So you're really solving something that would have become one.
Well, I would like to think we're the good guys in this.
Well, exactly. That's usually hard to explain to somebody on the other side of that transaction. And you probably had plenty of people on their team, whatever team that would be, their attorney or their accountant going, oh, no, you know, that's a...
Well, we were fortunate. I think we were in primarily a first-time buyer entry-level market. Not many of those people have attorneys and accountants and CPAs and
okay.
so forth. So, and that's not to say that we deluded anyone, but I think people were making their own decisions. They weren't looking to advisors. And I think when we really laid it out for them and showed them the level of risk versus the level of advantage, the advantages almost outweighed the risks. And like I said, two or three of them went bad out of
a thousand. Yeah, that's crazy.
I wish I could get those kind of results in business today.
The way the REOs were handled in the 90s, when did Mike Novak Smith join the company?
He's been here 20 years, probably about 97, 96.
Okay, so
I'm going to guess.
Right after the glut of those
had
come and gone. So this time they were in much larger quantity for a while, and then it just dissipated.
Well, this time they were from the beginning of the collapse, which would be the end of 07, I guess, that's when we saw it.
Yeah.
So in 08, there was a lot of rearranging, probably the last half of 08 and 09 and into 2010. We were doing four times the transactions we did in the years previous and since. It was remarkable the number of REOs that hit the market. Of course, driving prices down, drawing investors into the market might not have otherwise been there. But I really do believe that, I guess you didn't ask me, but I believe that had we just let that run, we would have been out of this problem in 3 or 4 years. Now we're 8 years past or 7 years past, and we're still not out of it.
Yeah, I've really thought about that too. I remember one time I looked in the San Bernardino MLS. There were 50 properties for every $1,000 price increment.
Wow.
You know, 51, 52 had 50 properties. Jeez. It was not a hard thing to be a buyer at a discount. and the lenders were taking about 80% hits on each of it. You know, so it was just like, oh my gosh, how much can this go on? They took some dings.
But the tendency is to want to clean it up. If I'm a lender and I'm upside down on 100 properties, I don't want to hold them. I want to move them. I want to get them out. Take the hit, take the tax write-off, take whatever I can benefit from it and move on.
And Moreno Valley is a really good test area because there's a little square box. I mean, I just closed on one. That's 1,300 square feet, just closed for $250,000 that I bought for something like 64. But it found its way back up because it was the target inventory of desirability for rental, a single-story, small house.
Right.
And so what you're saying was true. The market said, I don't have to pay 65 for that. I can pay 150 or 180. In other words, it's going to make sense better than anything else I have.
Right. It'll cash flow.
Right. So prices came back because there was all of a sudden more demand than there was supply even for that type of product.
Correct.
That's very interesting to me because that's the first time I ever remember when I did the study for that last report I wrote that a 3,500 square foot house in Hemet was selling for less than the 1,300 square foot house built 20 years earlier in Moreno Valley.
Interesting.
It was. And I just thought, okay, that's supply and demand.
But once you got above that cash flow point.
Yeah, then the buyer was not
buyer
the same
was gone.
Guy. Well, and we never had this buyer before show up with $1 billion that he has to spend.
Right.
So that, once again, you take a look at what should have happened, and then you find out, wow, the demand is so different for that particular product line.
That's true. I don't think there was ever the number of financially overwhelming buyers before any time before.
No.
Than in the last 5 years.
No, they never concentrated on single-family houses the way they have this time.
I think some of them are sorry they did.
Yes.
Maybe you're going there later. I don't know.
No, but, they're finding out that it's not the easy. Now, the equity gain, some of them are early for sure. But the ones that joined later and were pretending that the cash flow was going to be sufficient for everything are finding out it's not such a picnic to have rentals.
It's interesting that even some of the most sophisticated investors still get caught up in the hype. Real estate's going up forever.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, we face that every day at trustee sales.
Mm-hmm.
Every day trustee sales. That's that's worth 240. You just paid 236 and you haven't gotten in it yet and somebody's there.
Right.
good luck with that one. you've seen a lot of agents come and go. Have the requirements to be a good agent really changed over the last 20 years?
Yes, absolutely. Because I think agents are a lot more sophisticated today, and maybe I'm blowing my own horn a little bit, but I think agents are a lot better trained today, contractually trained, understanding the contract. You know, you remember years back when the purchase agreement was 2 pages.
Yeah.
We both remember that. Now it's 10 pages. Now it's print so small that I can't read it without glasses. And I think agents today are much more sophisticated, much more conscious of the contract and conscious of breaches of the contract. And I think that's good. When I watch a good experienced agent deal with another good experienced agent, the deal goes very smoothly.
And I would imagine they search each other out.
They do.
Yeah,
they
when
do.
You get offers and you have experience with somebody that knows what they're doing, I'm sure there's
Absolutely.
A leaning toward an easier escrow.
Sure, sure.
That makes perfect sense.
Reputation is a big thing.
been about 8 years since the crash. Is there still a lingering bad taste for real estate in some people's mouth to where they're just not going to participate again?
Well, you might have a better sense of that than I do. We, for the most part, we deal with people who are interested in sales or purchase of real estate. So I don't see the other side very much. But I would guess the only thing that comes to mind is just recently, this last year, when I would have assumed things were stabilizing and buyers were coming back into the market, we saw our marketplace fall to fairly slow movement. There's enough inventory. There are multiple offers on a lot of inventory, but there just isn't a lot of inventory. Whatever's out there will sell. But I think sellers are still afraid, and buyers are either afraid or they can't get into the market because of the loan underwriting criteria.
Do you have a lot of, I don't know, dry runs where someone says, I want to buy, and then they just, you can't?
In the last year, I've heard agents numerous times claim that they've had buyers that are within 2 or 3 weeks of closing, a long way into the loan process, when they find out they can't close. The lender won't do the loan. Now, that may be softening right now, but in the last year, that was a problem, more so than ever before. So I attribute it to the Dodd-Frank underwriting requirements.
Yeah, it's an uncertain time, too, because they just came out with the TRID, and
right.
All that paperwork is new, and the process is slower. I mean, we have properties that are in escrow 2 weeks longer than normal,
right.
Constantly.
And that's what the projections were, and they seem to be doing that, although you have the occasional one that runs off in a month.
What's your gut on interest rates, not knowing where they go, but how far would they have to go up before you'd say, okay, that's going to materially impact somebody's ability to get a yes answer to from a lender?
Well, that's a wild-ass guess. Sorry. I would say a couple of points with today's mentality. If they go from 4 to 6,
yeah,
I think people will back off,
okay,
believing that it'll come back down.
Okay. Mathematically, too, that may eliminate a
right.
lot of people getting a yes answer. The other thing, I've only got another minute or so. There's things that are expensive now that weren't expensive before to this extent, and yet they don't count against you, but medical costs, for one, and you have the deductible that's much larger. That's not really figured in a loan app, is it?
Well, I don't know. I hate to say I know, but I assume so, because people who were paying $200, employees who were paying $200 toward their health care last year or 2 years ago are now paying $500 toward their health care. That's a car payment.
Right, but their deductible has gone from $3,000 to $10,000 or something. In other words, in the back of their mind, I'm wondering if they're just going, I have such a chance to have such a big bill here.
That
I'm going to eliminate
possible.
Myself.
I don't know that I've thought about that, but that's a good question.
Yeah, I see the healthcare at the work, and I just for most people that could be a problem. Are young people, this will probably be our last question, are young people, the young adults, are they excited about owning real estate, or
I think the term young has gotten older. I think the young people who were maybe 23, 10 years ago looking for real estate are now 30.
Okay.
I believe. I think that the number of people living at home, not putting off marriage, putting off families, has really affected the number of buyers. There's a trough of buyers.
Household formations way
down. Household
formation. Now, that's one category that will correct itself ultimately. They're not going to always live somewhere with their dad or together or whatever.
I know everybody hopes that, particularly the parents.
Ted, what's your office number if somebody wants to give you a call?
We are 951-247-2213. That's 247-2213. Look at results-realty.com.
Okay.
All of the information's there.
All right, Ted. Thanks for joining us. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.